Hi guys, this is Jordan.
And I'm Maya.
And today we're going to be discussing the influence of the media on the case of the Menendez brothers. And today we actually have a special guest with us. So if Maya, you'd like to introduce them?
Sure. I guess maybe she could introduce herself. Jasmine, do you want to introduce yourself a bit?
Hi, I'm Jasmine. I'm 16 years old. And I'm from New Hampshire, but I live in India. I found out about this case in November of 2020 when I came across a 10-minute ABC video, and I became pretty invested in the case after that. That's me.
Jordan and I met Jasmine through her Instagram page, Menendez Justice, which we both really love her posts. Do you want to talk a little bit about why you wanted to make your page and sort of your process for doing that?
So I made my page because I saw a lot of misinformation out there, and I wanted to spread more awareness on the brothers' side of the story in regards to the case, as well as the defense evidence, and to debunk different myths and things that have been in the media for 30 years. So that's why I created my account.
Yeah, she does a fantastic job. I highly recommend people look for her page.
We'll put a link in the description of this video. So we're super excited to have Jasmine on for this episode. We'll be talking about the media presentation of the Menendez brothers case and how that had an influence on how the trial went and the eventual result. So trigger warning for this episode includes discussion of child sexual abuse, as well as mocking of abuse victims. We also discuss the crime scene and homicide. Maybe I should do a disclaimer about the cat. Can you see him?
A little.
He's here. Now he's not being loud.
What's his name?
This is Shadow. If there are cat noises in the background of this episode, it's because I have a cat named Shadow. So that's what that is. He's digging his claws into me. Yeah, you got yourself stuck. Okay. Anyways, I guess we should probably start with the beginning, like how the media initially presented the shootings of Kitty and Jose Menendez. Yeah, so the media at first kind of ran with this idea that the killings of Kitty and Jose Menendez were a mob hit. I don't really remember how they got that idea. Do either of you remember how that came up?
I think the mob hit angle came because Jose apparently had mafia ties, and people assumed that because he was a Hollywood executive and had apparent mafia ties, that they just assumed it was a mob hit.
Yeah, I mean, also Jose worked for Live Entertainment, and didn't Live Entertainment previously have ties to the porn industry, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And especially back then, like, the porn industry was like heavily tied with like the mafia and organized crime. I think that probably played into why people originally thought it was a mob hit, even though the crime scene does not look like a mob hit at all.
Yeah, that's kind of what, like, gets me is, like, I don't really know why they initially thought it was a mob hit, because I'm pretty sure a mob crime scene would not be as messy as this one was, and I don't think they kill wives.
Yeah, I'd heard that as well. I wasn't sure if that was a rumor, that, like, apparently, like, the mob just doesn't go after wives.
I think that's just in, like, film. I don't think that the mob actually stops and says, I'm not going to kill wives.
Probably not.
The mob hit idea was dismissed pretty quickly in the police investigation, I think. And then they kind of started focusing in on the brothers, but they, because they botched the initial investigation, they didn't have that much information connecting the brothers to the case.
I mean, aside from all of this, though, like, the amount of misinformation that there is, or that there was even at the time, was kind of insane. It was a lot of speculation.
I think the main one is the kneecapping. So there was a rumor that the parents were shot in the knees to make it look like a mob hit. And I don't know who got that idea, because they were not shot in the knees. I view it as something that was a rumor made up to, like, try to justify the fact that it didn't really look like a mob hit. Like, I think they just said that it was, that they were kneecapped and, like, made that up because they had said it was a mob hit, even though it didn't really look like a mob hit. And then they had to explain why they said it was a mob hit. So they said that the brothers tried to make it look like a mob hit, even though it's very clear that they didn't. I don't know. That's how I view that rumor.
I mean, I've seen some people reference the, what was the thing in the second trial that the prosecution used to try and, like, recreate the crime?
Failure analysis,
that's it, yeah. And, like, in that recreation of the crime, like, didn't they have it so, like, the parents were killed, like, execution style first, and then shot, like, in body parts afterwards?
Yeah.
Because the prosecution tried proving that, like, some of the wounds to the body were post-mortem, like, specifically, like, the leg wound to Jose. And then the defense had to bring in an expert to counter that and be like, actually, there's no way to tell either way.
Yeah. I mean, that was not something that was ever brought up in the first trial, because the coroner disproved that.
It's also important to remember that the failure analysis people, they had never reconstructed a crime scene, and they were like computer engineers. They had never worked on an actual crime before.
Yeah, I think in, like, a news report, that there's, like, a really interesting article that you can read online about failure analysis and their involvement in the case. But in that article, like, some of the defense, like, a defense expert or someone that was analyzing the testimony of failure analysis noted that, like, they just ignored, like, some of the blatant physical findings in order to come up with their recreation.
Exactly. And I think, like, the DA's office spent millions on that witness instead of just having the coroner come and testify again.
It's because they didn't like what the coroner had to say.
The kneecapping is the one that bothers me the most, because it's the most prevalent myth in, like, every single piece about the brothers. I think even prosecutors, like, there's an interview with Carol Nehara, and she says that they made it look like a mob hit and that they kneecapped their parents. But Jose didn't even have any wounds in his knees, near his knee. Like, there was just a thigh wound on one leg.
Yeah, but to me, like, the kneecapping is just so... It's one of those lies that's been allowed to sort of fester in, like, the public consciousness surrounding the case. And it's just ridiculous. Like, if you ask, like, a random true crime fan who knows of the Menendez case but hasn't really looked into it that deeply, they probably will straight away be like, oh, yeah, they kneecapped their parents to make it look like a mob hit. I feel like that's such, like, a commonly held view surrounding this crime, and it's just a blatant lie.
That's something that confused me for, like, the longest time. The coroner never testified about, like, the kneecapping, for example, but every article spoke about it.
This kind of goes along with another myth that like Kitty was asleep on Jose's lap when they were shot.
That one makes no sense either, because she's lying on the floor by his feet. She didn't just like roll off of his lap.
Yeah, I think that also ties into the whole like something that I've seen, like I think it's on the Murderpedia page about the case, and I've seen like loads of true crime YouTubers repeat this, is that Kitty got up and then ran towards the hallway and then slipped over. And it's like, if you just look at the crime scene photos, she's next to Jose on the floor. She didn't run anywhere.
I think the prosecution even tried to bring that theory in with her shoe, with her bloody shoe. They tried to say that she was trying to run away or something.
I mean, the thing is that she didn't make it very far. Like, she did not run anywhere. She was right next to him. So even if she was trying to get away, which, you know, she probably was, because two people just came into the room with shotguns, she did not really go anywhere. Like, she clearly just fell where she, like, she was standing next to him or stood up next to him and then fell to her right.
I don't know. It's another one of those, I think, I would just say lies that's sort of spread about the brothers to make them look worse. When the crime, like, it was already, like, bad. Like, you don't need to throw in these, I don't know, I think it's sensationalist. Just for the sake of it. I mean, you also had the strawberries and ice cream myth, which I feel like it's just sort of thrown in there to like make the brothers look worse.
Yeah.
Even though there's no evidence for it whatsoever.
I think Leslie talks about it in her book, and she says that, you know, it was just another thing that a rumor that was based in the coroner's office, and then eventually people found out about it and the media just ran with it.
Yeah.
They were not eating strawberries and ice cream while watching a movie on the couch.
The police never actually tested the glasses to see their content. And there was just like, there were two empty glasses on the coffee table. Unless they put them down and then got shotgunned to death.
So I think with a lot of these lies or a lot of the misinformation about this case comes from like sensationalism. And this case was highly sensationalized in the media. Yeah, Leslie Abramson, Eric's lawyer, went on a show.
Oh, the show Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher.
The show was about media coverage of crime and criminal cases. And they sort of perpetuated this myth that they had blown their parents' heads off. And she was correcting it and saying, no.
You defended the Menendez kids. What do you care about facts? Seriously.
And I didn't remember seeing you in the courtroom, Bill, so you absolutely don't know anything about the facts.
I know they blew their parents' heads off.
No, they didn't.
And they reloaded.
They didn't blow their parents' heads off.
The Menendez kids didn't blow their parents' heads
off. No.
Stab them?
No. What? Stab them? Where have you been?
I don't know.
My goodness.
Wait a second. What did they do?
They unloaded shotguns in their direction, but they didn't blow their heads off.
Let me ask you one factual question. Did they reload?
No, they didn't reload.
One of them reloaded. All right.
You know, it does make a difference since I represented the one who did not reload.
Okay. Of course.
What is the distinction? You're saying they shot in the direction, but they didn't...
No, I'm saying they didn't blow their heads off. You said, did they blow their heads off? No, they didn't. Their heads were still on.
Well, the direction was wrong.
In fact, they didn't blow anything off.
But if you point
a shotgun at someone and pull the trigger, obviously it's going to cause damage. That's what shotguns were designed to do. You know, know, I'm sorry, I don't see why.
This woman is crazy. She is really crazy. I can't believe that
don't call me crazy.
Don't call me crazy.
I'll tell you what I am.
You object to cameras in the courtroom, and you can make remarks like that. I mean, cameras
remarks
in the courtroom
like what?
Can actually tell. They didn't blow their heads
they
off.
They didn't
everything
blow their heads
intact.
Off. You don't care whether a fact is accurate or a total fabrication. Well,
of
why don't we
I
just
do,
say... Why don't we say they blew a 5-inch hole in their chest?
They killed
that's
them.
That's just
they
as big a lie.
They killed them. That's what the issue
well,
is.
That's a different issue. If you want to say they killed them, yes, they killed them.
That's right, Bill. She's got you. You were arguing
would
about
like,
the location
would
of
you
the
like to retract your statement, sir?
All right. You're part of the problem.
Ooh.
I'm part of
this
the problem.
This is part of the problem of why people don't understand what's going on in our courts. Or the distinction.
Don't patronize me, please.
Well,
do not patronize
how can
me.
I not patronize somebody who laughs at the idea of people
laughs
being killed?
Laughs at the idea.
But
you're making a mockery
you must,
of your own
you
clients.
Must,
no, I'm not.
You certainly
no, I'm not.
Were. They didn't blow their
but,
heads
but
off.
But Leslie,
no,
you
No,
must...
I'm not. You're making a mockery of being a lawyer. You obviously have no loyalty to anything but your own celebrity.
But
my own.
Yes.
I didn't realize I was one. I'm sorry.
Well, you're trying very hard.
Aren't we supposed to be making a mockery? Isn't that the idea? What's wrong?
But you must understand that people out there watching this are saying that this woman is not making is making a distinction between things for which there really is no distinction.
Of course there's a
distinction. Which is what they hate lawyers for doing, is that these two...
There is a distinction.
There is a distinction.
You were talking... This,
what is the distinction?
Let's
what
go back
really
to what this was about.
What does it really
this
matter?
This was about fact. It really matters what facts are. Truth really matters.
They killed
so
them.
When you, but that's a different issue. If you
no,
said they killed them, I would have agreed with you.
What does it matter if
but,
they blew their heads off and
the
blew their hearts out?
Because you used the... They didn't do either. You used the phrase, blew their
what
heads off.
What did they blow?
Wait,
what did they blow?
So he's not supposed to see
exact
semantics.
It has nothing to do. You know, Maestro, it has nothing to do with being a lawyer. It has to do with wanting to inflame the public by using hyperbolic language, by bringing up grim images, whether they're real or not.
Or
using
it has to do with distracting the public with semantics, like you're using.
Okay.
The law uses
did they blow
no
anything?
Color.
All right, I have to take a break. I wish I didn't, but we'll come back.
I mean, I think it's just another example of, like you said, like, it's sensationalism. Like, the media is just, like, perpetuating these things or making them sound even worse for the sake of, like, the story that they want to present.
And I mean, Leslie, in that interview, makes the point that, like, at one point, the interviewer says something like, well, it doesn't matter, they killed them anyways. And she's like, it does matter, because it's not true. Like, you're straight up lying, and you're not willing to correct yourself, and you're going to continue to spread these sensationalist lies about, you know, facts of the case. And that's what skews people's perception of crime.
Yeah, she even says that you don't actually care about whether a fact is true or not. And I think that it speaks volumes about the entire case and how it was treated by the media.
So the brothers were arrested for killing their parents in March of 1990. And when they were first arrested, I think most of the media coverage was about the money they had spent from, like, in between the time that they killed their parents and the time that they were arrested. So the main theory was that they had killed them for the money. And this was perpetuated by the DA's office. And I think even in the initial, like, press conference announcing that the brothers had been arrested,
the first thing that people thought about was how could they have committed such a brutal crime? And it led people to immediately believe it had to just be about bad seeds and money and greed.
$14 million provides ample motive to some people to commit murder. And one sometimes does not need to look beyond that as a motive.
I mean, that really shows you how, like pinpointed they were in on this one theory that they had, and they weren't willing to budge on it at all.
I mean, I also think that speaks to how sort of sensationalized the case was, because it was in Beverly Hills with all this money. They had set that tone from the very beginning, and they weren't willing to present a different image when they got more information. Even when all this contradictory information started coming out about the abuse.
I think it also plays into why when you see like a lot of like people above the age of 40 or middle-aged people talk about this case now, a lot of them always say, I was there at the time, I lived through this case. And I think it's the reason why they have such strong opinions is because they lived through that time where all they were seeing on the media, like in the media, was the brother's spending habits after the killings. And like that was the bulk of what they heard at the time. Because there was a 3-year gap between when the brothers were arrested and the start of the first trial. So imagine that's a lot of time for like the public consciousness surrounding a case to set in, you know?
So there was an article on People magazine about 2 weeks after both of the brothers were arrested and arraigned. It was one of the biggest articles and pieces on the case, in the beginning at least. And it was quite biased to the prosecution, obviously, and it had a couple of myths like the berries and ice cream and that the crime scene wasn't indicative of family rage.
Yeah, that quote from the article, it says something like the grim and calculating nature of the crime scene doesn't speak to family rage. And then it also says that they were both shot multiple times and that it was a messy crime scene, basically. And I'm like, those are not consistent statements. It was, I don't know, in my perspective, looking at that crime scene, it's clearly emotional family rage.
The defense didn't reveal the abuse until close to trial, and I think that was a mistake. I think they should have come out of it a lot earlier.
I think the reason that they waited was because of Lyle, because he didn't want to testify. And he didn't want, I think that he was really, really reluctant.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point, actually.
Yeah, I had not thought about that.
People say that they didn't, like, they were in prison and jail for 3 years and they never made allegations of abuse until they realized that they were going to go on trial. So I think if they had made the allegations earlier, it would have been more, like, expected.
Yeah, like, I think, like, people here, like, they didn't make abuse allegations until close to trial, when in reality, they had already revealed the abuse to their family members in 1990, the end of 1990. Like, so that's almost 3 years before the first trial. But most people don't know that. Like, you wouldn't know that unless you've watched the trial, I think.
I mean, that being said, there were a lot of hints in the media coverage of this case that there was abuse in the Menendez family. In Dominic Dunn's first article about the Menendez case, he, like, starts this, like, really long article by talking about a conversation that he had with someone who was a Beverly Hills kid, and he was on a plane sitting next to him and Dominic Dunn asked this kid about what he knew about the Menendez family, and the kid said something like, I heard the dad was really rough on the kids. I'm like, okay, obviously that's not an indicator of sexual abuse, but that's an indicator of abuse, and that's in an article from 1990 before the brothers had publicly come out and said that they killed their parents. I mean, and that's like a stranger, someone who didn't even know them, saying this. In that early article as well, in Dominic Dunn's first article, he says that someone told him that there was incest in the Menendez family. I don't know. I look at that 3 years before the defense was revealed publicly, and it's like people shouldn't have been surprised that it ended up being true. I mean, that's in one of the first media articles.
Yeah, exactly.
Another thing in the media coverage that kind of early on that hinted at sexual abuse was there's the photo of Lyle on Jose's lap where Jose is groping him, or like Jose has his hand on Lyle's genitals, and Lyle like has his hand on Jose's hand and looks really uncomfortable. That picture was run in multiple news articles about the case before the brothers went to trial. None of those articles ever talk about the fact that Jose is groping his son in the picture. They just put it in there as like a, oh, fun family photo.
I don't know how they didn't recognize that as like really shady. Like, that's not normal.
Articles and documentaries will crop the photo. Like, there's a article where Diane Vandermolen came forward, the brother's cousin, to talk about why she believes them, and they use that picture, but it's just their faces. It doesn't show the bottom half where Jose is groping Lyle. And it's just like, I don't know, that's just so blatantly obvious to me that they are trying to characterize one narrative of this case, you know? Like, you're going to take...
Do you think it's intentional?
I feel like it has to be at that point. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, I kind of agree with you, because personally, I don't know how you can look at that photo and not see where Jose's hand is. Like, it's very blatant. And they have to go to effort to, like, crop that image as well, rather than just putting in the entire image.
I'm imagining, you know, a family member giving that picture to the media to be like, look, here's evidence of sexual abuse, and then they crop the picture.
If they didn't think anything was wrong with the image, they would have just put the whole thing inside, right?
I mean, I've seen people, multiple people, like, downplay that picture and say, like, oh, it doesn't really look like he's groping him, or I don't think it's that suspicious. But it's like, he's groping him. Like, I think it's very obvious.
Yeah, I think so. People also say that he was trying to make Lyle, like, not fall off of his lap by holding him like that. But then if you look at the way he's holding Eric, I don't...
Yeah, he's holding Eric around Eric's waist, right? Which is, you know, normal. The defense put up a picture that was taken right before it where Jose's not groping him.
Yeah, where his hand is, like, slack.
I've seen some people make the argument, too, that Jose couldn't have been abusing his sons because if he was, then he wouldn't have had that picture taken. That's just dumb. So it's like, okay, he's groping his son, but that means that he wasn't sexually abusive because a child molester wouldn't have a picture taken like that. It's like, okay, who would have a picture taken like that?
Yeah. I feel like it's also the sort of thing where it's like hiding in plain sight, and you can... It's the sort of thing where, like, an abuser would probably, like, think it's, I don't know, kind of funny, maybe, that he's doing something like that in plain sight. And if anyone asks him about it, he could just argue it as, like, oh, I was just holding him. Like, that's just where my hand just happened to be placed at the time. Like, you know what I mean? Doing it for the arrogance, yeah. Because they know that, like, no one's going to question them about it.
He has, like, a god complex.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, like...
I think that about covers, like, the hints about sexual abuse.
Just after they were arrested, yeah.
So the publicity of the Menendez case led to it being one of the first trials to be completely televised and have a camera in the courtroom. This was the trial of the century before OJ. Like, it was on all the time. People were talking about it. Even, like, President Bill Clinton said that he watched, right?
Yeah, he used to, like, after dinner at the White House, he used to go into his room and watch the trial.
And I mean, this led to some people possibly coming forward with false information, because they wanted to get on TV. So there was that element of the media influence on this case, that being involved meant that your name was out there in the public sphere and things like that.
Like an example is like Craig Signorelli, like in the hearing where he didn't think that he was going to be on television, he wore like jeans and a shirt or something. But then when he came to testify, he was all like dressed up in his suit. And I think Leslie even points that out.
In fact, you got dressed up today to be on camera, didn't you?
No, I got dressed up because, I'm sorry, can I answer that?
Yeah,
objection's overruled. Thank you. I got dressed up because I'm in a courtroom and this is my future.
You were in this courtroom last Friday and you were wearing jeans and a white polo shirt, weren't you?
That's correct, because it was supposedly, from my understanding, an informal hearing.
I mean, I think more so for someone like Craig, I can just sort of imagine it being like, wow, this is such like an exciting thing in my life, and I could be known as the person who gets like Eric Menendez sent down for murdering his parents. So I can sort of see it from that angle, like, because there's so much media coverage at the time. It must have been quite like an exciting thing to be involved.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that led to people like misconstruing the information they had, or trying to make it more incriminating, because, you know, at the time the brothers were like, I would say some of the most hated people in the country. So we've mentioned Dominic Dunn a couple of times in this episode so far, but Dominic Dunn was a reporter for Vanity Fair, and he covered the Menendez case pretty extensively. And he was, like, outspoken about the fact that he was covering it from a prosecution angle and that he believed the brothers were lying. I think that's where a lot of the hatred and like people's general attitude about this case comes from, his coverage.
Do you guys know, like, the details surrounding what happened to his daughter and probably why he is so pro-prosecution?
She was, like, an abusive boyfriend. And he killed her and he got like voluntary manslaughter, and he only spent like a couple years in prison. Yeah, after that he covered most cases pretty pro-prosecution. And maybe a lot of his hatred for the brothers' defense of abuse stemmed from the fact that his daughter's abusive boyfriend got away with murder.
I think that probably is true. I mean, there's some other weird stuff about Dominic as well. Like, allegedly, like, he's passed away now. He had, like, copies of Eric's, like, modeling photos.
Yeah.
And apparently he, like, repeatedly sent letters to Eric when Eric was sent to prison. If you had such, like, a definite view about this case, why are you still, like, trying to be in contact with one of the perpetrators? Like, I don't know, it just seems really weird to me. So during, it was during the trials where Lyle was corresponding with a woman named Martha Shelton. So this was just someone who, I'm assuming just Lyle saw them like as a friend, because like they got thousands of mail. So they corresponded with a lot of people. But this woman, Martha Shelton, came out and said that she had tapes of her conversations with Lyle, and that on a tape that she has Lyle on tape saying that he like snowed or fooled half the jury. He just has to, half the world.
It's, we snowed half the country, now we have to snow the other half.
Yeah, so when she said this, the police at the time actually like served a warrant to look for these tapes. Turns out they didn't exist. So she's clearly lying about having tapes of it. Martha Shelton like came out and said like it was a lie, like Lyle never said that. They still ran that quote in Eric Tells All.
Like, Eric Tells All is the best documentary on the case. Like, it is the most accurate. in my opinion. And it still has a lie in it.
And then years later, she comes out and says that she only said that at the time because Dominic Dunn had paid her to make it up, and that Lyle never actually said anything like that to her. Like, come on. Like, if there's anything else that you need to know about Dominic Dunn, aside from that, like, I don't know what else.
I mean, to be fair, he denies that that happened.
Yeah, of course he will.
But he admits that he paid her. But he says he paid her because he felt bad for her.
Oh, yeah, like, I was paying her. Yeah, like, I was paying her, but, like, I didn't tell her to say those things about Lyle.
Yeah, I was just being nice, okay? I just sent her $1,600 for the heck of it. You know, she went to jail. Not for this, but she used to pass as, like, Rachel Jones and stuff like that. So she got convicted of, like, identity theft and harassment, stalking. It's like,
I still feel like the biggest indication there that it wasn't true is the fact that those tapes didn't exist.
Yeah.
And that she was just asked to say that.
Right, exactly. To me, the bottom line is, Lyle never said that.
That is just, to me, that's just like one of the biggest indicators that Dominic Dunn is a bullshit artist. I mean, I don't know what it was like back then, but when you think of like Vanity Fair now, like a big Vanity Fair article comes out about like one of the most talked about criminal trials, you're probably going to look at that and take it sort of as the truth. I'd assume even more so at the time when there was no social media and no sort of like other news sources outside of the mainstream.
Yeah. These articles were one of the first things I came across. And I thought that, you know, if Vanity Fair is covering it, it will probably be pretty unbiased. But his articles were extremely inappropriate, almost. Like the comments he made. It was kind of like mocking the brothers and their testimony in a lot of the articles.
So he wrote like four articles about the Menendez case. One of them was after the first trial, or like towards the end of it, after the defense had been presented. He talks about the brothers' testimony, and he, first of all, he like characterizes it like a soap opera, and he's like, oh, Lyle's tears were so compelling, and like, I don't know, it just really irked me the way that he talked about it. Like, it was, like, this grandiose acting performance. But he never mentions any of the other evidence that they were telling the truth. Like, the naked pictures never comes up. And, like, I think because he never mentions it, like, no other articles mention it. Because he is, like, those articles are the source of a lot of information about this case.
Like, when you actually evaluate all of the evidence in this case, there is so much that Dominic just leaves out that he just doesn't mention at all, probably because it doesn't fit his view of the case.
And I think in one of his articles, he said something like, so he was abused as a kid, I think. And he says something like, why didn't anyone see bruises on me and stuff like that?
Do you think there's a part of him that did
believe them?
Believe it, but because of his job and who he was sort of known as in the public eye, he sort of had to go with the accepted narrative.
Yeah, that, and I think he had a lot of hatred, like, towards things, especially, like, a defense like this.
According to Robert Rand, who was is a pro-defense reporter on this case, we highly recommend his book. After Lyle's first day of testimony, Dominic Dunn approached Robert Rand and said that he believed Lyle. But then, like, a couple hours later, went on a like TV program and said,
I think like the exact quote is that Dominic Dunn said, I didn't believe a single word that came out of his mouth merely hours after saying to Robert Rand, I believe him.
But then in his article, he says something like, or even in, he made a documentary on the case. And have you guys watched it? I think it's called Power and Justice and something.
I think I've seen it. It's on YouTube.
Yeah, there's Pam and David Kahn and all of them.
And yeah.
He says something like, even I had tears in my eyes, but then I watched the same moment on TV and realized it was completely rehearsed.
What?
Yeah. I don't know, like, what that's even supposed to mean.
Well, we've kind of touched on this a little bit, but the defense didn't come out publicly with the sexual abuse claims until, I think it was like 10 days before the start of the first trial, right?
Somewhere in that time span.
Yeah. So I think that did lead people to be extremely skeptical of these claims. And when the brothers testified, they were even like mocked in an SNL skit.
Good evening. I'm Greg Jarrett for Court TV. It was a startling day of testimony at the trial of Lyle and Eric Menendez. After several weeks of presenting its case, the defense stunned the courtroom with a revelation that not only are there two other previously unknown Menendez brothers, Danny and Jose Jr., but that they in fact committed the murder with which Lyle and Eric are charged. Later this afternoon, younger brother Eric joined Lyle on the stand, and in riveting testimony, they spoke of the secret existence of these two previously unknown Menendez brothers and the years of emotional abuse they suffered.
Now, is it true your father never allowed your other two brothers, Danny and Jose Jr., out of the house?
Yes.
And that he never allowed them to go to school?
Yes.
Yes.
Never had them in family pictures or mentioned them to friends?
Yes. Yes.
No driver's licenses, no birth certificates, no social security cards.
My father said Danny and Jose Jr. didn't deserve to have any official records of their existence because they were weak and not good tennis players.
So in other words, it was as if your father didn't want anyone to know your other brothers even existed.
Yes.
I think it was trying to portray them as, like, creating an excuse. None of the stuff that passed 30 years ago would pass today. At least I hope not.
Yeah, I just think it would be viewed as, like, I mean, which it is, like, extremely insensitive.
I think Eric talks about that in Eric Tells All, where he's like, I was sitting in the jail cell, and he sees, like, the SNL skit and, like, Michael Keaton mocking him and stuff. And these are people that they looked up to, people that they liked. And
Yeah, imagine seeing, like, your favorites, one of your favorite celebrities on national TV mocking you.
Yeah. Have you guys watched that Kathy Griffin video?
Oh, yeah.
Where she, like, literally makes a rape joke.
Big News court reporter Kathy Griffin has an update on the Menendez brothers case. Kathy?
Thank you, Ron and Terry. Well, we're back at the LA courthouse awaiting the retrial of Eric and Lyle Menendez, the two Beverly Hills brothers who killed their parents. And after viewing the evidence and seeing the testimony in the first trial, let my boys go. Oh, come on, they're so adorable. They are too fine to go to prison. Whoa! And you know what? Lyle's my favorite. I'll tell you why. I know he wears a toupee and everything, but you know what? It's not about looks. When you're a guy like Lyle, it's just not about that. Get over it. And let's face it, Kitty and Jose had to go. Here's the deal. You stick a toothbrush up your six-year-old kid's ass, he gets to blow you away in the family room. That's the rule. Leslie Abramson, go on, girl. You're doing a great job. And all right, I know they don't exactly have an airtight case, okay? Lyle went on a little bit of a spending spree a week after the murders. He got a couple Rolexes and a $70,000 Porsche. But you know what? Sometimes you just have to treat yourself. You do. Make yourself feel better. Like one time I went to the mall and I got a whole bunch of caramel corn just because I felt like it. And the other thing is, Lyle is my boyfriend. He just doesn't know it yet. Well, he could be. All right, here's the plan. I think that Lyle and I should get married, and we should live in the main house. And then Eric should live in the guest house, and I'll tell you why. First of all, Eric is a loose cannon. He's more troubled than even Lyle, and he's all hopped up on the Xanax all the time. Anyway, that way the boys can be close to each other, and yet Lyle and I can still have the privacy that newlyweds crave. Oh, it'll all work out so perfectly. As long as I don't get him mad. This is Kathy Griffin for Big News. Back to you in the studio.
Disgusting.
She says something like, I guess if you stick a toothbrush up your 6-year-old's ass, you get to blow. That means he gets to blow you away in the family room. And I was like, yeah, I think so. I think it just shows how much the media spun their story as completely fabricated. And in order to do that, they ignored mounds of evidence that the defense put on. I think a lot of the media coverage, including Dominic Dunn, likes to point to only their testimony and say, look, they lied before, they could lie again. But that's just ignoring everything else. Like we kind of went over in our previous couple videos about their claims, like there was so much evidence that they were telling the truth that wasn't their testimony, you know?
Yeah, that's how I see it as well.
I think if you don't, if people didn't watch like the trial back then, there's no way that they would be able to believe it, you know? Because like,
because the media never, they always say they claimed sexual abuse and that's like the end of it.
Like I've not read one article that talks about the nude photographs or Andy Cano or any of them that actually corroborated the case.
I've noticed there's like, as far as I can tell, there's nothing online unless it's like going back to like the 90s when the trials were going on that actually talks about the experts like Dr. John Conti or Dr. Anne Burgess. Dr. Stuart Hart, there's just nothing about them relating to this case online.
Yeah, they're just completely overlooked.
And I've, like, for me personally, their testimony was very significant for me.
Yeah, for me too. Like, I believe the abuse, like, pretty much straight off the bat, because, I don't know. And, but I didn't believe that the whole fear for their lives defense until I listened to Dr. Anne Burgess. And then that was very corroborative.
Yeah.
I mean, then there's also the, like, Alan Dershowitz abuse excuse book, which he talks about this case. The book Abuse Excuse was written by Alan Dershowitz, who's famous celebrity lawyer. Does one of you want to talk about that or explain what that was?
Well, the abuse excuses, I guess it would be in reference to essentially defense teams concocting false stories of abuse in order to get their clients off of whatever they're being charged with at the time. So in the brother's case, it would be that they had created this full story of abuse in order to excuse their actions in a way.
I think it's sort of like the argument that these people were abusive and so they deserved to die, which is not what the defense was in this case, but that's how a lot of people viewed it. Essentially like vigilante justice of these people hurt us so we get to hurt them.
A lot of people don't know about the things that actually led up to the killings. So all they were hearing is that these two people are claiming that they were abused and then they killed their parents. But they leave out that whole chunk of the week of the killings. And that's what the term abuse excuse does, that they think that because they were abused, they killed their parents, but they leave out that essentially the heart of of the defense.
I think it mischaracterizes the defense completely.
Yeah, and Alan Dershowitz, he's been accused of being involved in sex trafficking and having sex with like a 17-year-old who was being trafficked by Jeffrey Epstein.
I feel like just the fact that like Alan Dershowitz sort of coined the term abuse excuse and then sort of like applied it to this case is more demonstrative of just the general like public perception of the case at the time.
So because of the way that the media portrayed the case in the 90s, it was pretty difficult to, like, I think it was pretty difficult for people to get an unbiased opinion of what happened. And so unless you were watching every day of the trial, it was probably difficult for someone to believe the brothers. Do you guys think that if you were learning about the case in the 90s, you would be able to believe them?
I feel like the empathetic side of me would want to say yes, but knowing that back then, I probably wouldn't be watching like every day of the trial. I probably wouldn't be interested in the trial back then, actually. So all I would really be hearing about the case is through like word of mouth. And since like social media and the internet wasn't really a thing back then, it would just be word of mouth and whatever I saw on the news or like in an article. So, and seeing as like the media was pretty pro-prosecution at the time, I probably wouldn't have believed them. But who knows?
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel. I just feel like the information that solidified my belief in their story was the stuff that wasn't publicized. And I don't think that I would have. I mean, I think the only way I would have believed them is if I watched the whole trial. But I also feel like if I had grown up in the 80s and 90s, I probably wouldn't have believed them, because I think people in our generation have a lot more information about abuse and like the impact that abuse has on the brain and how prevalent sexual abuse is as well. So I think I probably wouldn't have believed them.
I think at the time it would have been pretty hard to believe them. I don't think I would believe I wouldn't believe the imperfect self-defense part of the case, because that you really do have to sit through the whole trial to get an understanding of.
Yeah. I mean, they did have quite a lot of people at the time that did believe them, right? Because they got a lot of mail.
There were a lot of people that did believe the abuse and supported them and were writing to them about their own abuse experiences. I remember in Robert Rand's book, he says that every day that Lyle testified, he kept a different letter in his pocket of someone who had written to him saying that they weren't believed about their abuse experience. I don't know, that really stuck with me.
Like, I remember in Eric Tells All, there's like footage of a woman who like drove around in her car, and on the back of her car it had like a big like poster that said, "I believe Eric and Lyle."
Yeah.
Not being on the jury and not being their lawyer, there's a limit to what I can do other than show my support.
I wonder what happened to her.
There was also like, I think outside the courthouse there were like demonstrations of people showing their support for the brothers.
I mean, some of the people who were outside the courthouse were like the fangirls, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, they do not come across very well in Eric Tells All, because there's literally just a string of them get interviewed one after the other, and they would basically just say, "I think they're really attractive, and I think they're innocent," and like it's very like immature.
We still have that going on with people.
It's actually crazy.
I feel like that kind of like really tarnished people's perception of the defense too, that all of these people were out there like equating their attractiveness with their innocence. And that sort of put this whole other layer of, I think, negative perception of the case, because it was viewed, and I think it still is, of like, oh, if you believe them, you just think they're hot or whatever.
Leslie Abramson was known for being quite mothering towards Eric. And I think she has like said in an interview, like, I would have been happy like to raise Eric and like he wouldn't be in jail right now. So she was very mothering towards him, but she was also sort of like mocked in the media for being like this as well. And people questioning her and being like, wait, does she think she's mommy? Like, why is she being so caring and mothering towards him?
The media portrayed the way the defense presented the brothers as very much trying to make them look younger and treat them like kids. But with Leslie specifically, she would like adjust Eric's sweater and put her arm around him when she was talking to him in the courtroom, stuff like that. I mean, I don't know. I don't really view it as that mothering. I think it got completely misconstrued by the media.
I just don't like see it as a big deal. Like, it's her client. Like, she obviously knows him on a deeper level than most other people at that point. So like, even if she was like particularly like mothering towards him, like, I don't really understand why that's an issue or why that was called out so much. Also, like, I'm unsure if like if it was like a male attorney and he was sort of treating his client sort of like a son and being kind of caring towards them publicly, like, would they have been scrutinized in the same way at the time? I don't know.
I don't think that a male attorney would have been as scrutinized for doing something like that.
I mean, there's plenty of times in the trial where like you can see like Michael Burt wasn't like fatherly or anything, but he was like friendly, especially like with Lyle, and like joked around with him, and like you can see them like laughing together and stuff. But I've never seen anyone talking about that. Like, it's not the same, but
I think I don't know. Media had it out for Leslie, like in general. Like, articles about her always comment like about how short she is and her frizzy hair and all of that stuff that they would not comment about a male attorney.
I mean, I think that's another thing that Leslie Abramson got criticized for, is she was very kind of loud and outspoken, and I think that was sexism towards her, of like, oh, a female attorney shouldn't be brash, I guess. I don't really know what the right word would be to describe it, but like, she was definitely, she really took the lead on the defense in this case. And I think out of all of the attorneys, she was the most confrontational, I guess. Yeah, I think confrontational is probably the best word. And I think she got criticized a lot for that. I do not think a male attorney would have been criticized in the same way that she was. I mean, that's their job.
I think people considered her like aggressive and they didn't like that. They weren't used to lawyers being like that. And even in the past, like with her other cases, she was really outspoken about things that she considered wrong. Like, there was this Pakistani gynecologist who was accused of like mutilating and chopping up his son. And she defended him, and that's a different thing, but she said that, I want everyone in this county to know that the district attorney is okay with sending an innocent person to the gas chamber. So I think she said things that people viewed as really unacceptable at the time, especially coming from a woman.
So one thing I've read online is that there's like a sort of a conspiracy theory, I guess, that the media took such a hard pro-prosecution angle with this case because they were trying to like protect how many abusers were in Hollywood and like how prevalent sexual abuse is in Hollywood, which today I think we know a lot more how common, you know, sexual favors or like sexual abuse is because of the Me Too movement. But yeah, I'm wondering, what do you guys think, that it was kind of like intentional that they decided to present the brothers' claims of sexual abuse as completely false?
I think there could maybe be a hint of truth in that some higher-ups in certain industries probably could have been worried that the brothers could know something that they didn't want out. And so there was definitely like a combined force to sort of push out the narrative that the brothers were lying. Maybe. That's like conspiracy theory stuff, but...
There's that... Have you guys read the transcripts of the Larry King thing?
Yeah.
Where Dr. Vickery says that there were people that had been molested by Jose, but they couldn't talk about it because they were in the entertainment industry. So there is a possibility.
I don't know. I think it's an interesting theory. I mean, I feel like with the media too, it's like, even though the jurors weren't supposed to know anything about the media coverage of the case and stuff like that, I think it was unavoidable in terms of the pressure that there was on the jurors to convict the brothers and the pressure on the prosecution to convict them too.
Yeah, I mean, even like according to Hazel Thornton, she's said that
the women on Eric's jury had reason to believe that some of the men either were watching the news or had a source of information that I believe put pressure on them to convict rather than to be seen as gullible in the eyes of the public.
So I think that tells you a lot about how much influence probably the media had even on jurors at the time. And that was during the first trial.
Yeah, I think she also said something like the men were really scared of being like portrayed as really emotional when it came to
that. Yeah. Like they didn't want to be known as like the male jurors who got the Menendez brothers off.
Yeah. And the defense did like a $45,000 survey before the second trial to prove that because of all the media coverage and attention, that a jury pool in Van Nuys would be poisoned or biased.
Yeah, but I mean, they went ahead with the trial there anyways.
Yeah, it's stupid. I mean, as much as those second trial jurors want to, like, scream and shout that, like, they were, like, completely unbiased when they went in and, like, they just did their job as jurors, I do not believe for one second that there weren't at least a few jurors in their second trial who were like, yeah, we're like, we're convicting these brothers.
I think they went in with that mindset, a lot of them, that
yeah.
When they walked into that trial, they were not thinking that I'm going to just wait for all the evidence and then decide.
I think the other thing with the second trial and the media coverage around it was that because of the media coverage in this case, there was so much pressure on the DA's office to convict the brothers. I think that if the media hadn't attached itself to this case and covered the case as extensively as they did, that the brothers would have been given a plea deal after the first trial. Because the abuse evidence was so overwhelming and all of their family members supported them and wanted, you know, didn't want them to be sentenced to death, I think the only reason that they went as hard as they did in the second trial is because of the public perception of the case.
I think even like they've even like Carol Nahara, I think she says something in like the recent, I can't remember what documentary it was, but it aired like late last year. And she talks about what the like atmosphere in the DA's office was at the time. And it was this, like, they were like publicly embarrassed to the extreme. So it was like, they really had to go hard on the brothers in the second trial.
Because the DA's office was already being, it was pretty much a mockery of the justice system at that time. They lost time and time again. And then they have this highly publicized trial, and they just had finished another one, right? They finished the OJ trial, lost that one, also extremely publicized. Then they have this other one that's been publicized for like 6 years. They can't afford to lose that one. I also think that the reason that they went for the death penalty, like, I think Gil Garcetti is pretty anti-death penalty now. But at the time, I think if he said I don't want to go for the death penalty, it would have looked really bad on The Office, considering the fact that the DA before that tried the brothers with the death penalty.
Yeah. So, like, because he was the new DA, it was a bit like, oh, the previous DA, like, went for the death penalty. If I don't do that, I'm going to look weak in comparison.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they did a lot of shady shit in the second trial to get the brothers convicted.
Yeah. I read an article that was, like, really good about how bad the DA's office messed up this case. Like, I do think that there had to be something shady going on between the DA's office and Weisberg. Like, that's a theory, and there's not a lot of evidence that supports that theory, but I think it's a big possibility. Maybe Weisberg was also influenced by the media, that because of the media attention, even a judge would be prejudiced.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just doesn't make sense to me why he would allow the first trial to go the way that it did and then completely reverse so many of the rulings in the second trial. I mean,
he like went back.
Shouldn't he be like impartial and not take what he already knows about the case into consideration when he's making his rulings?
Yeah. I think they had the same judge. Like, that didn't make sense to me.
Yeah, they shouldn't have had the same judge. I don't understand that.
So one difference from the first trial to the second trial was that Judge Weisberg banned cameras in the courtroom in the second trial. So I don't know. What influence do you think that had on the case?
Personally, I think he knew what he was going to do, and he knew that he would be scrutinized if people saw the way he made his rulings in the second trial versus how he made in the first trial.
That's a good theory.
It was also like a week after the OJ verdict, and I think a lot of people say that's the reason that he probably banned it from the second trial, because of how cameras played out in the first trial as well as the OJ trial.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think in the OJ trial, even more than in the Menendez trial, the defense really played to the media and played to the cameras. So I think like that makes a lot of sense to me for why he would change his ruling on the cameras in the courtroom. Yeah. I think the media influence on this case is a huge part of the reason that the second trial went the way that it did, and just how publicized the case was in general. That had an influence on how the jurors acted, how the prosecution acted, how the DA's office acted.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like with the fact that the brothers were, even after they were convicted and sentenced to life without parole, that they were then separated and sent to separate prisons for more than 20 years. I mean, I don't think that would have happened without the media coverage of the case. In the sentencing, there's a clip of Leslie where she says, like,
it's ridiculous to say that they shouldn't be together because they would commit other crimes. The probation report indicates they are not a danger or a threat to anyone. They have not committed any other crimes. They did not conspire over the 6 years they have been together in the same smaller institution, the county jail. And the probation department recommends that they can be kept together and that they will be an asset to any institution they are in. And this is just an attempt, a last-ditch attempt, by the prosecution to inflict even greater punishment on them than what the law prescribes. And I see it as exceedingly cruel and heartless. I don't hear them making statements like that about serial killers, about baby rapists. But because these are highly notorious defendants, thanks to y'all, they think it's a free-for-all for inhumanity.
Which is true.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of the really cruel elements of how this case was handled in, like, the justice system came from the media coverage of it.
Jasmine, do you still have access to the probation reports?
Yeah.
Because I think those probation reports are really, like, enlightening about what the wishes were of the people who were actually close to the brothers at the time.
Those were from after they were sentenced, right? Or was that...
It was after they... Yeah, I think it was after sentencing, yeah.
I wonder why Detective Zoller wanted them in two different prisons. Like, there's no... I don't buy his explanation of it's because they would conspire to commit other crimes. I don't buy that.
I think he's just a vindictive person.
Yeah.
I mean, in most cases, when you have the family of the victims saying that they don't want their killers to be separated or to be sentenced to life without parole or to get the death penalty, like, the court would listen to that. But because everyone else in the universe was saying the opposite, they just ignored what the family wanted. And I mean, even to this day, the media continues to perpetuate lies about the brothers and to run with this media narrative of the rich kids who killed their parents for the money. And I mean, they put the brothers up there with people with, like, serial killers, which just bothers me so much.
I see people do that all the time, like, in tweets or comments, like, when they're talking about, like, heinous killers, like, they like, list out certain people, and they're like, Ted Bundy, Jeffrey Dahmer, the Menendez brothers, and I'm like, what? How can you even put those people in the same...
I read an article about weird people that get married in prison, and there's, like, Richard Ramirez, Ted Bundy, and then you have, like, Eric Menendez, Lyle Menendez. And it makes them sound, like, just as bad.
I mean, I feel like it's just, like, the media has run with this narrative of the brothers being these sociopathic, greedy, rich kids for so long that, like, from the very beginning, from the moment they were arrested, they took that angle. And it's just so frustrating that I think no amount of evidence will change some people's minds about this case because of the way that it's been presented for 30 years and the way that evidence has been ignored and misconstrued. And yeah, do either of you want to have any final thoughts?
I hate the media. Yeah.
That about sums it up, I think. Jasmine, I mean, you're welcome to, we love talking to you, so you're welcome on anytime.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. I had fun. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. We had a lot of fun talking to you too. We don't know what our next episode is going to be.
We don't know what the next one is yet.
But thanks for listening.